How's that?
I think
one day I feel so.
Well, look, thank you.
Now, what would be my story if that were the case?
Oh, no. So, that's not what I meant.
You can, but I can't answer it.
And there was this indescribable welter of emotions.
I think
to this day,
I will never accept
it. It was
that.
Like something that
never
just sort of snapped in my head.
And look, I don't know. It's a miracle.
And I hope that the people listening to us will enjoy what they hear.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Ian Thorpe won 9 Olympic medals and somehow made it look easy, moving through the pool in such a way that he appears to be just rocketing along and going in slow motion at the same time. Ian released a memoir called This Is Me, and one of the things he's revealed is how he feels in the water, how aware he is of the other swimmers, and when he knows when something's wrong. In some ways, the swimming is the simplest part of his life so far. He is a swimmer of such exceptional speed and grace that naturally people see him as a kind of magic worker, capable of pulling off the same miraculous feat again and again. But it's clear from his book that Ian knew full well that he was, after all, just a human being and not at all worthy of the overblown language, however well-meaning it might be. He stepped away from the pool in 2006, but he came back again because it still gives him so much pleasure. Welcome, Ian. I'd love you to start by reading from the opening chapter of your book, please.
I've come to the conclusion that I'm not going to win against the water, that I'll drown eventually, because it doesn't matter how good you are, there's only so far you can swim before it takes over. When I first dive into the pool, I try to work out how the water wants to hold me. If I let it, the water will naturally guide me into position, a place for my body to settle, resting with my head down, almost meditating. This is the starting point for me, not just floating, but lying flat on top of the water. Then I begin to initiate movement, lifting myself, pushing with my chest and engaging my muscles. That's the basis of the way anyone should swim. Although it's not the way we learn, because we're not taught to connect so intimately with the water. As I begin to swim, I allow myself to feel where the water is moving around me, how it flows off my body. I listen for any erratic movement, which means I'm not relating to the water, and I have to modify my stroke, change it, until I feel the water moving smoothly past me. I can do this at a low speed, or very high speed. It's really rewarding because I receive constant feedback without stopping. I don't need someone to tell me that my stroke looks great or that it looks terrible because I have an inner sense of the water and the environment is already communicating with me. If I'm swimming next to someone and they aren't swimming properly, I can hear it, even without looking at them, although I prefer to swim by myself. Elite swimmers tend to become very territorial of the water around them, as if we own it. We don't want anyone else messing up our water. At times, especially when I feel as though I've swum well, I'll turn around at the wall and look back to see what the water is doing. I look for telltale signs, like little whirlpools, which mean that I've created the right amount of turbulence as I've moved through it. This is why I've returned to the pool, not for the medals and the records or to relive past triumphs, as most people assume. If that happens, then I'll be happy. But if not, it doesn't mean I've failed. I'm doing it because swimming was an integral part of my life, and I felt forced to abandon it. Now, I want it back.
In that, I kind of get a sense of your pleasure in the water. And no matter how many times you go for a swim, you know, that moment when you plunge into the water, for a split second, it's a shock and a comforting thing all at once as a swimmer. Maybe that's got some psychological thing about going back to the womb or something. Do you still feel that kind of shock and pleasure all at the same time upon plunging into the water, Anne?
I often wonder, well, what is it about the water? And I think that there is a disconnect from when possibly we are in the womb to when we actually learn how to swim. I think it's why children, when you put them in the bath, most of them love it. You take them to the pool, they enjoy it. And then we start to say to children, oh, you have to be careful of this. You know, don't do this. And this is all for safety. And I understand why we do it, because of the fear of what the pool can do. Because swimming isn't ultimate. You either swim or you drown. It's one of those things that I think we get taught out our natural instincts that we have around water. And for me, it is a pleasure to be in the pool. You know, when I come, when I've had a Sunday off and I dive in on Monday, it is a shock. I don't feel as connected as I have, you know, for the previous week. And that first session on a Monday morning is a difficult one because the dive into the pool, you notice that there's something different and you have to readjust to being back in that environment.
I nearly drowned once in my 20s in the surf off the coast of New South Wales, and I came close to, and that was a real shock, because the feeling that water might actually, which was once a wonderful thing, might actually take me, was a real profound shock to me. Have you ever had that feeling, thinking that the water might get the better of you this day?
Well, I didn't. I went with one of my much older cousins, and we went to the beach, and the beach was closed. And beaches are closed for good reasons. It means don't go in. But we decided it's okay. We'll swim out, go under the waves and, just swim out the back and, then come back in. And really underestimating the power of the water. I can remember, having to dive down under the waves and actually grabbing the sand to not get sucked back up into the wave and coming up and being breathless, like trying to go out and then realizing you have to go back in. Now, when you get into that state where you are stressing your body in that way, where you realize that what the water can do, you get tired very quickly. And this is where people fall into, a lot of problems, is that they underestimate the water and they overestimate their own ability. And so in swimming in, counting waves to work out when you could get a breath and a decent breath, when there was a break to actually swim and stop and just be in the same position and having to spend 45 minutes gradually coming back in and then being absolutely exhausted after it. It's one thing, and it's a good lesson to learn to respect the water and to know your limitations.
Yeah, that's the lesson you get, is how insignificant you are to that body of water. You're a dot.
Absolutely.
That's, and the ocean doesn't care.
That's right.
Did you have a pool in your backyard when you were growing up in Sydney?
We did. We had an above-ground pool, which is really annoying when you're a child because you're not allowed to push off the walls, which is kind of the fun part of it. So if you're going to get a pool, either get one that blows up where you can't push off the walls, or put one in the ground, or just go to the beach.
Your grandparents were a big influence on you growing up, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. We were really close to my maternal grandparents because both of my parents, they worked. And so, before school sometimes, but always after school, we'd be at my grandparents' house. And it's something that I really valued, that time that we were able to share, when I was young, the things that I learned from my grandparents. I learned how to cook from both of my grandmothers, actually, but especially on my mum's side of the family. And also my curiosity for making things from my grandfather, who can solve every solution to every problem there is. So if there's something that's broken, he can fix it. This has always been what he does. He had a great workshop. So we used to spend hours out there, and me learning all of those things that so many people that are my age or similar kind of missed out on. And I love that, that you can skip a generation and information flows from grandparents to grandchildren. It's, a very Eastern thing to do. I see it a lot in Japan, where the grandparents' responsibility in the family, living in the family home, is the upbringing of the children. And I think it's a great way to connect to tradition as well.
I'd like to be able to say that, swimming was everything for you as a little kid, but Lego was really much bigger, wasn't it?
It was. I was a Lego fanatic. And when I was young, when I was very little, I used to always go to the Lego exhibition, which was always at Darling Harbour. And when I was very young, that was what my goal was to become the person who put together all the Lego in this huge convention centre.
That's a good ambition. That's a lovely idea, isn't
it? Yeah. I think so too. Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit Willy Wonka-esque, is the child that doesn't want to grow up. And that was me. I was in my room playing with Lego whenever I could as a young child.
How did boredom lead you to take up swimming, Ian?
Look, I started swimming because my sister, it's a very roundabout story, but my sister broke her arm falling off a hill that was the best part of 30 centimetres. She broke her wrist, and the doctor told her to get in a pool to strengthen the muscles around it. So she started swimming. I was then dragged along to swimming carnivals for a number, like probably 2 years. And swimming carnivals as a kid are really boring. And I just wanted to be doing something else. So mom suggested, well, if you do one swimming lesson a week, you can probably go to these competitions and swim at some of them as well. And so I went, oh, okay, then, well, I'll start doing that. I started when I think I was, probably 8. I did half an hour a week. And when I was swimming, I was allergic to chlorine.
Yeah, now that's a big deal. Allergic to chlorine.
Yeah.
And so how did you manage that?
Well, first I had to find out why I was getting sick. So I went and was tested for all of these allergies. And so it turns out I'm allergic to chlorine. So
what kind of symptoms would it produce, getting your head underwater?
Like sinus problems, like quite bad. And I used to get quite sick. Like every 2 or 3 weeks, I'd be out of the water for a week because I was sick. But I enjoyed it, so I'd go back to the pool. And, I ended up wearing a nose clip and whatever else, which you know, got rid of some of the problems. But when I had the test, the doctor who did this test, you know, suggested to my mom, if she thought if I was going to be a champion swimmer, I should have my adenoids in my nose removed and I wouldn't have problems with this anymore. And she said, no, don't worry. We don't think this is really going anywhere. It's just kind of what he does.
Yeah, settle down, everyone.
Yeah, calm down.
But he's going to be in the Olympics, you reckon?
You know, and, you know, my parents were also asking themselves, is it okay, you know, for a child to go swimming when they're making themselves sick? And I was asking them if I could go swimming and then I'd get sick. But, you know, as you grow up, you have less and less of a problem with this. So as you, you know, reach puberty, the adenoids have shrunk to a really small size then, you know, so I had less problems, you know, once, you know, I hit that stage of my life.
It is kind of funny though, because my daughter has allergies and she's attracted to the food she's allergic to. I just wonder if there's anything in that as well, like you being attracted to the thing you're allergic to.
Well, when you're told you're not allowed to do something, of course you want to do it.
You invented your own kind of little dog paddle to keep your head above water, didn't you? This little funny stroke.
Well, it is. It's now a drill that I do in training now. And I remember swimming like I used to race with my head out of the water. So like a water polo style. But then I used to have to train with a nose clip, which, you know, I also thought was one of the daggiest things that you could possibly do. So the deal was that I didn't have to race with it, but I had to train with this thing on. Because I was a backstroker as well. So you actually have a lot of water that goes up your nose.
Does the smell of chlorine make you feel a certain way now?
It does. That over-chlorinated smell of an indoor pool, I dislike it because it's hot and, you know, it's quite exhausting when you walk into that environment. I really dislike training in indoor pools. I like training in outdoor pools just because you don't have that smell of chlorine around the pool. And I think it's a much healthier environment as well because I know when I changed from swimming in a 5-lane, 25-meter pool, you know, I was, you know, 14 when we changed from that pool to a 50-meter pool. So I was on the national team swimming in a tiny pool. So it's not facilities that make people good. It's the training that they do. And, you know, everyone in the squad that moved to the new pool, all of us had less health problems as soon as we were outdoors, you know, swimming. So I think, you know, indoor pool's great, possibly for loner swim, but not for that squad kind of training.
Who knew? It's healthier to be in a body of water that's not full of pool chemicals. Mm. Yeah. At the beginning there, you give a lovely, really lovely picture of what it's like for you to be in the pool. And you have a lovely way, I don't know, it's a kind of spatial thinking I think you tend to have there, knowing exactly where you are in the water and how you're moving through it. Is that different if you're in the ocean, for example? We talked about that earlier. Can you still get that same feeling?
You can get the feeling. It's more difficult, though, because there's a number of different forces that are at play when you're swimming in the ocean. And it doesn't matter which direction. If you're swimming out, if you're swimming across one way or swimming the other way, the different currents and the feeling of the water moving in is different. And even when the water's behind you, you know, pushing you in, there's so much sensory kind of feedback that you get when you're in the ocean that it becomes quite chaotic when you swim there, or it does for me.
So is that information overload?
It is, because I'm trying to monitor what the water's doing and it's too much. And it's why, you know, for me, being in what feels like a very sterile environment, swimming in a pool by myself is ideal for me to, you know, to learn about water, to learn how to swim well.
I assumed it was a kind of an instinctive process, but it sounds like you're really actually in a pool trying to compute quite a fair bit of information in the front of your mind.
Well, it's self-monitoring. Like if my stroke fills out, it's usually never the stroke. It's something else. And it will be an issue of, do I have the right amount of tone through my hips? Is my kick out? And it's just monitoring, well, you know, this isn't feeling right there. So it probably stems from something else.
Are you aware of the other swimmers in the pool?
I am. And mostly they irritate me because they're distracting me from what I'm doing.
They're creating turbulence.
Well, it's not just turbulence. They're creating, you know, noise. You know, it's my lane and someone next to me can disrupt what I'm feeling in my own water. So it's why I like to swim. And even how I race is to get out of other people's space so that I can have clarity in what I'm doing.
Does that improve your competitive spirit? Because it's like, you bastard, you're harshing my good time here in the water. I'm going to beat you.
Well, I'm not into beating people. You know, someone suggested I was trying to be quite cute by saying that. And I'm not. I look at when I get in a pool, and for me, it's the self-improvement, because if you just go in to try and beat someone, you're going to limit what you can possibly achieve. It's the same with looking at winning. You can win a race by 1/100th of a second, but if your potential is to win it by 4 seconds, it's better for you to have gone past what is a barrier for everyone else. If it only becomes about winning, I think you end up limiting yourself and, you know, what you can potentially achieve.
I was fine with The Simpsons. There's an episode, there's a moment in The Simpsons that's analogous to any life situation. There's a thing where Bart fakes his test results and he's mistaken for a genius and he's brought in front of the principal and they start measuring his scalp with a tape
head,
measure.
Yeah.
Given that you evidently had a kind of extraordinary swimmer's physique at an early age, did that happen to you? Did people come along with you with, you know, tape measures and measure your feet and arms and hands and that kind of thing?
I don't think I did. I didn't have an ideal swimmer's shape until I was very successful. Then it became the shape that everyone said was ideal for swimming. I haven't seen
that. So that's a rationalization that happened after the fact?
Yeah, absolutely.
But you got very large feet, don't you? Wouldn't that have been obviously a benefit for a swimmer?
Yeah, but I'm also over 100 kilos. So, you know, that's not so good for a swimmer. I mean, I look like a rugby player. You know, I look like a rower. I don't look like a swimmer. You know, everyone else is very thin, very lean, broad shoulders. You know, that's the characteristics that we associate with a swimmer. And, you know, there hasn't been really too many other swimmers that I've seen that, you know, have a similar physique to myself. And with this, you can look at all the things that may be, you know, complementary to my swimming. But, you know, with all of that, you know, with an increased amount of muscle mass, and I'm going to fatigue quicker than everyone else. So I've had to find efficiency more so than anyone else in the pool, because I will get tired before someone else because my muscles suck up so much energy.
Wow. Whereas, so this whole theory that you're made to be a swimmer is something that's been kind of decided after the fact.
Yeah, it really was. And I even went, you can have all the tests done at the AIS and basically the computer spits out what sports you should do. And never me for swimming. It's not on all of the measurements. It's not for swimming. But, you know, I look at, you know, my physical characteristics and I do think that they're good for swimming. If you have the ability to be able to be a technician and work on technique, you know, there's an advantage to having more weight from, you know, when you dive in the pool, that when you hit, you're going to be able to project further. And the amount of force that you actually put into the water when you go in, if you can hold that position, means that you're going to be able to, without doing anything, go further than everyone else. So, you know, that's an advantage just by doing nothing. So if you're like a bigger size swimmer, you really want to get out of the way of the water. If you just try to do it on brute strength and forcefully going through, you're going to fatigue very, very quickly.
What do you mean by get out of the way of the water?
Well, the water wants you in a particular position. And there's a part of the water which is between, it's the movement of the surface. And think of the amount of force that what we call air, so the world is pushing on water. And then whatever you do to the water, you can't really break it. It's going to move that pressure from the air, the atmosphere going down on it. It's going to move the water to a different position. And so you don't want to wreck that process. You want to be involved with that process where the water can move around you and hold you rather than trying to pull or push your way through that water and breaking where the water wants to be. You know, others will talk about, you know, I want to have, you know, a really long stroke, have a good high elbow catch, and talk about these details that are characteristics of what I do when I'm swimming. But I look at my whole body. I don't look at those individual parts. At times I have to work on them. But I ultimately want to see how I move as a complete unit through the water, not going, I want to introduce more kick. It's usually a reflection of what I'm doing with my stroke.
When I'm doing laps in a pool, it gets a bit boring after a while. For you, though, you kind of see all the science. There's a kind of little challenge you set for yourself. Is swimming for you a kind of experiment on yourself?
Yeah.
A kind of a Frankenstein-type experiment to see what
not
you can
Frankenstein,
do?
Not Frankenstein, because it's a bit extreme. But I'm testing myself. And I enjoy, you know, that exploratory side of swimming and seeing what I can do in the water. This has always been the appeal. And people say it's boring, and people, you know, and everyone reinforces the black line, you know, looking at the black line. I don't see the black line. You know, it's something that's in the middle of the lane. If I have my own lane, it's directly underneath me. If I don't, I swim around it, but I don't see it. And for me, it's not a boring process. I'm doing something and it's more like, you know, rehearsing with a musical instrument and hitting the right notes over and over again and getting satisfaction from that. And then being able to use that so that we go to what would then be a performance piece, which is when you race. You know, this is how I feel about my training and racing.
Do other thoughts intrude? Do thoughts like, oh, I've got to pick up the laundry, or that kind of thing intrude when you're swimming competitively? Or what did I do last week? Oh, yeah, I've got to make sure I take care of this. You know, the day-to-day, you know.
Not competitively. In training, yes. Like, the wonderful thing about swimming, and I look at this a little bit like it would be something similar, and I'm assuming this because I've never done it, would be to doing some farming work. I know I feel this when I'm gardening, but it's the opportunity to just allow passive thought where, you know, things are allowed to pop into your mind and then be dismissed. There's time for that as well, because you're doing something that does have some repetition to it. So you're allowed to have that time. And I think as we get, you know, live a faster life, fewer and fewer of us get to experience that. And, you know, it's a really healthy thing to allow that freedom of thought just to come into your head.
It's the story, and I know you're aware of this, of the swimming coach Forbes Carlyle, who once trained a swimmer very successfully to win the national title in 1955. What do you think about that, the idea you could hypnotise a swimmer for success?
I don't know. I think it's possible.
It's interesting, isn't it?
It really is. But Forbes Carlyle was an innovator in swimming. You know, if we look at some, you know, of the equipment that we have, like goggles, this was something that Forbes came up with, the pace clock, some of the training techniques, you know, all around Forbes Carlyle. So he's a brilliant man that also, he has one house that is all of the documentation of swimming history. And next door, he lives in that other house. <It's>, and so, you know, he has footage that is used, Olympic footage that no one else in the world has. And so when they have to go through libraries, they have to ring Forbes Carlyle to get that footage.
And you were a very successful student while you were being a swimmer, and you were getting very high grades in school. Did you have ambitions for yourself before you became a swimmer?
Well, after I went through wanting to be a Lego engineer, if that's a job, I'm sure it is. If you're in,
sure it is. I'm still hoping to get that gig one day. This radio thing's a stepping stone.
As I keep on mentioning it, I am suggesting that people are listening over in that other part of the world, but. Then at school, I decided I wanted to be a neurologist. I really don't know why, but I...
Brain Lego.
Yeah, brain Lego. It then became parents' reaction, okay, well, you're going to have to study hard. and, you know, I was a good student. You know, I did really well at school. So it when I made the decision to leave school, only having completed year 10, which I actually did at home, I didn't go to school when I completed year 10. And my father wanted me to remain at school. My mother said he can always do it later. And I think it was a conversation that they must have had separately, that they needed to give me something that was giving me some sense of freedom, because I think they must have felt, if we don't give him something now, there's going to be a time where we can't negotiate with him, that, you know, we'll give him this one so that we can keep him closer. And you know, I often think what my life would be if I had stayed at school, if I hadn't gone down the path of swimming, if I'd stuck in, went to university, where would I end up? Would it have been a very different life that turned out for me? You know, most of the time, I'm very glad that I took the path that I did. You know, I had to educate myself when I'm traveling around the world, because I did live out of a suitcase from when I was 14 or 15. And, you know, for me, it became books and it became experiencing the world. And this is how I taught myself about life. And I had a thirst for knowledge as well.
Because you travel a lot, don't you?
I do.
You sit on planes and buses and there's nothing to do except read, really, is there?
So, it's read or look out the window. Yeah. And, you know, there's a certain height you get to on a plane where it's not very interesting to look out the window, or it's nighttime, or you've seen that crisscross of farms in Europe, you know, a number of times. So, yes.
You're actually kind of an aesthete, seems a little overblown as a word, but you're a cultural guy. You're like interested in art, music, culture. And did being a champion swimmer sort of kind of protect you from getting your head beaten in the playground? Because that can attract unhealthy attention from kids, can't it?
Yeah, I was also bigger than the other kids.
Yeah.
I think that probably helped more. But, you know, I think that maybe because I'm in sport, but, you know, interested in other things as well, you know, it makes for an interesting childhood. Because, you know, usually, I guess, you know, sport and having good marks don't go hand in hand. And, you know, I know a number of exceptions to that rule. And I will argue that, you know, physical development in education is incredibly important, whether you're good or not good at it, because of the lessons it teaches, especially for younger children. You know, I think that there should be more value placed on the combination.
When in high school, tell me how you managed to bring Lego into your nutrition experiment, Ian Thorpe.
Well, this is me being the not just the black sheep of my family, but being the black sheep. I had to write, and I don't know why I was writing about this in science, but it was about nutrition, and I decided that I wanted to see whether or not mice performed better in a maze that I made out of Lego, where I changed which direction so they couldn't potentially learn which way to go, so that the mice couldn't cheat if mice have the knowledge of what cheating is. And so I fed half, you know, the diet that is recommended for mice, which is water and some rubbish that you buy at the pet shop. And then the others, I gave them green cordial to drink, and I think they were twisties. They may have been cheesels. I'm not sure which one it was. But, you know, both of those things have a lot of numbers on the back of them. So I went, you know, this is possibly the worst thing to feed to mice. And I'm looking at it now, and I'm probably going to have people from PETA saying, you know, that's inappropriate. I was a child and I didn't know. And for the sake of science, I was doing this.
But we give this stuff to children, though.
Exactly. What does that say about us? But anyway, the interesting thing was, I thought, you know, of course the mice on, you know, the proper diet are going to win. And anyway, the mice on the bad diet won. And so it ended up being something about hyperactivity in children is what I ended up reporting it on. It was one of those things that, you know, science didn't give me the answer that I wanted, so I had to find out a reason of why that could be possible.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Ian Thorpe is my guest in conversation. Ian has released his autobiography that is called This Is Me. The outside world, Ian, as you were in high school, saw you as a boy wonder, but how did you see yourself? What was your kind of self-image?
I think more of an awkward teen. You know, this is how I saw myself. And also, I felt a little as though I was an imposter because I was tremendously successful, yet, you know, I couldn't understand why. You know, I knew that I trained hard. I knew that technically this was all right, that this makes sense. But it felt like it was just such a bizarre set of circumstances that, you know, very quickly from being a child growing up in the suburbs, I was world champion and then breaking world records and then Olympic champion. I always felt that I'd be too young to swim at the Sydney Olympics, that, you know, it's great that, you know, we have a home games, but unfortunately this is a little early for me. You know, this is when I'm 12 and 13. And then comes 14, where it becomes a possibility. You might actually make the Olympics. You know, how exciting is this? My goal was to make an Olympics. And my dream, which is something that you don't usually talk about, because you think it's something that is set up in the clouds, you know, that it's probably not going to happen, it was to win an Olympic gold medal. It's quite strange for me because, you know, I never realized that it would happen. I was amazed by it, and it shows that it is there for everyone. It's available. You know, those lofty aspirations are attainable. This is how I felt about the Sydney Olympics.
Now, people are using language to describe you that you'd normally use for Nelson Mandela, and you know you don't deserve that, don't you? And you feel that must gnaw away at you a little bit.
Well, I stopped reading and watching myself. You know, you should be uncomfortable, like seeing yourself, you know, watching yourself, hearing yourself. You know, I was never as good as what people said. And the same on the flip side, I'm not as bad as people will say as well. I'm somewhere in between.
You know, I think when we're teenagers, we want to be both highly visible and invisible at the same time. Mm. For most teenagers, you have to struggle to be visible, and so you do stupid things. Being invisible is not a real problem, but it would have been just the inverse for you. You would have struggled to be invisible at any point and struggled to have those moments where you feel you're unobserved, the pleasure of those moments.
Yeah, it's something that when you have a certain level of fame in your life that you're always going to struggle with feeling as though you're not being watched. You know, I lived in a beautiful house in Sydney with a beautiful view, and always having the blinds drawn because you realize then how exposed you are to people actually looking in. And it's the same. I may go to a hotel and the first thing I do is close the curtains, because you always have a sense that, you know, people are watching. And it's just that you need that time for yourself.
Is this the point when depression started to make itself present in your life?
No. It had been there before then.
Well, how young?
Young. You know, and I realized through...
What, before 10 years?
Yeah, well, I think now looking back, at the time you don't know it. At the time you think, you know, this is just, you know, me feeling a little bit strange. But when I look at, you know, how I was feeling at different times, yeah, I can see, you know, depressive symptoms. But as a child, you don't know how to articulate that with anyone. You just think that's, you know, part of being a child.
So it's showing symptoms then before you become a nationally prominent swimmer.
Absolutely. It's something that I believe, you know, with something like depression, that it's something people are born with. And then obviously there's environmental factors that can contribute to it as well. And, you know, that's the same for anyone, not just someone that may be in the public eye. So, you know, it was in my teens that I realized that I needed treatment for this.
What was the nature of that depression, or that was it a kind of melancholy, a blueness or exhaustion? What sort of kind of form did it take?
All of the above. You know, melancholy, the loneliness, the tiredness. Now, you can say tiredness from training, the melancholy possibly from, you know, what I'm doing in training. The loneliness then makes no sense because I'm surrounded by people, and surrounded by people that are close. But then when it gets to a point where the things that usually give you enjoyment, you take no enjoyment from them, you realize that it's something that is significantly more.
Did anyone see it?
No. Only people that I allowed, which, you know, basically were people in the medical community that I'd speak to about this. My family didn't know. You know, close friends didn't know. And I think in later years, you know, some people did know. You know, I had a coach that knew as well.
Looking back, I mean, I don't want you to name names or anything, but did you become aware that there were other swimmers going through something similar?
Yeah, look, I think in sport, we can safely say that there's probably a higher incidence of depression than there is in the greater community. I don't think it's because of sport. I think sport attracts us because, you know, you feel better after being involved in sport. You know, the endorphins that are released are really good. And if you see someone about having depression, you know, they'll suggest, you know, doing more exercise because of the way that it makes you feel. All of us might fall into sport because of, you know, that reason, or people with depression may lean towards sport. And, you know, what I know, it is anecdotally, it's, you know, something that I don't think's been studied, because I looked for it to see if anyone had done a study, if there was a elevated level of this. But, you know, how I speak, it is anecdotally from people that I know that have depression, or people that know of people with depression in sport.
I say this because I think one of the happiest moments I've ever seen you in sport is winning that relay in Sydney 2000 with your fellow team members playing air guitar. You seem to be really enjoying that moment of silliness for a start.
Well, I am. And I did enjoy this. And, you know, for people to know, if you have depression, you go through stages where most of everything that you experience is very normal. There's just some periods where you have lows, but you still experience quite extraordinary highs as well. But for me, and telling people about this, you know, for me managing it, you know, I'm best when I'm in competition, which is a highly stressful kind of situation to put yourself in, very exposed, where you'd actually think it was the opposite. But, you know, this is usually when I'm at my best in terms of handling depression, feelings of anxiety as well.
Most interesting moments I ever saw with you on television was the moment when you came second to Peter van den Hoogenband in the 200 metres. And once you saw that had happened, what I saw was a completely authentic sense of pleasure for your friend, Peter van den Hoogenband.
Yeah. Like, yeah,
you seem to be genuinely, authentically happy for him.
Well, I was.
Was it as uncomplicated as that?
It really was. Because I'd won, you know, I'd fulfilled my dream the first night of that competition and exceeded it. You know, people ask, what's it like to win an Olympic gold medal? And you can spend an hour trying to explain it and you'll never be able to explain it. And I don't care what kind of grasp you have for language. There isn't the words, the feelings, the emotion and the way that we can express ourselves to share that with someone. So the only people that know this feeling are others. And when you can look at someone and know exactly what they're feeling, you don't have to say anything. People may see Peter as one of my competitors. I see him as one of my friends who I raced against. You know, the same with Grant Hackett. It's the same thing. And, you know, after, you know, winning my gold, I saw other Olympic gold medalists and it's just like, you know, I know what you're feeling. I know what this all feels like. You don't have to say anything.
That moment when Kathy Freeman won her race, she
went through that elation or that complex feeling, or if it's a simple feeling, I don't know, of having one gold, by sitting on the ground. There's something really lovely about that.
It was. I watched Catherine, you know, when she won, because everyone says, was it just that you were overcome with the pressure and the expectation, the weight was lifted off your shoulders? And she says no. She had all of that, but it was joy. And it was how she expressed her joy, was to sit in that moment. When it happens, there may be a roar from the crowd, but good athletes, you know, we internalize things and then we have a spatial awareness for our environment that contributes to it. And we have an acute sense of both of those things coming together. That's when we produce our best performances. And so I understand that reaction.
You've also just been moving about as fast as you've ever moved in your life, too.
Exactly. So there's a bit of a rush. You may have just been tired.
That's part of it, too. Afterwards, you were the kind of toast of the town, toast of the whole world, really. I mean, remember you went on Jay Leno's show after that. You were kind of world famous. Was that a kind of a time of an unalloyed joy for you after the Sydney Olympics?
Yeah. Well, it's when I realized I needed a break. Yeah. You know, I knew what the next kind of... And I was then looking at 4 years of training. You know, in Sydney, there was a brief moment at the closing ceremony where I considered, well, maybe I move on with my life now, where I decide to stop because this is magic, this is perfect. It was just a brief moment where I considered it. Then that went away. And I knew I needed time out to prepare myself for the next 4 years. I enjoyed myself and I enjoyed, you know, the travel and traveling around the world, experiencing different places, being in Japan at this stage, which, you know, really blew me away as a, you know, a teenager going to Japan and the response that I had in Japan. It was a very exciting time.
You were in New York City on the 11th of September 2001. Tell me how your day started.
Well, it started with me waking up far too early because I just arrived from Sydney the night before. I assumed that a friend of mine, Michelle, she'd wake up and she was going to go for a run, and I told her to wake me up when she got back. We'd had an argument about what was better. I'd been to New York before. I'd been to the top of the World Trade Center. And I said, no, you do the World Trade Center in the morning and you do the Empire State Building in the evening. And she said, no, you should do it the other way around. And I said, no, you do. This is the way. And this is the way to do it,
that is
by
the
way.
That was the way to do it, yeah.
So I woke up early and I actually went downtown from my hotel. And so I actually was at the World Trade Center that morning before all of this unfolded. I would have gone uptown, run around Central Park, but it was so early that it was, you know, there's going to be no one on the streets. I'll go for a jog.
It was a beautiful day too, wasn't it?
It really was. And I can remember that walking back was, wow, New York's beautiful today.
So you were at the World Trade Center?
Yeah.
You were there at some time early that morning?
That's right.
And then you didn't go up?
Well, no, because it was too early. So I went back to the hotel, turn on my television. It was on MTV. I know it was on MTV. All of a sudden, it cut into MTV with the footage. And it's then at this time that, you know, I am watching this on the television going, this can't be happening. And I saw it and I got my friend Michelle and said, we have to watch this. And couldn't believe what was happening. Well, I rang my mum at that stage and woke her up, knowing I'd wake her up. And I said to her, look, Mum, there's been a plane that hit the World Trade Center in New York this morning. Michelle and I were fine. We're not so close to it. And, you know, don't worry about us. We'll speak to you, you know, when it's an appropriate hour, basically. So in my mum's mind, she thought a small plane. She didn't think of a jet. And so then we had no communication. You couldn't call from New York. And so, you know, waking up to that news the next day, it must have been shocking for parents because you realized and you had a sense that the world had just changed at this point in time.
Where were you in Manhattan watching all of this?
I was kind of in the lower part of Midtown.
Oh, man. And so did you go outside and see what the sky looked like?
Well, Michelle and I actually walked closer to it. I know it sounds like the wrong thing to do. And we walked down to get closer to it until we started seeing people with ash and the soot, and then went, no, that's wrong. Where there's people fleeing, and we, out of curiosity, are going closer. And so, you know, we kind of returned to where we were. But the worst part of it was after it, there were all of these rumors going around that the plan wasn't just to hit the World Trade Center. It was to have everyone on Manhattan, and that they were going to drop anthrax over the city. because of all the people that commute there. And so you had New Yorkers looking up, which usually doesn't happen. All the time, you'd see police around iconic buildings in New York, like evacuating the area because there'd be fake hoaxes, you know, people calling in that there's, you know, a bomb in this building. And so you were constantly leaving. And our hotel was close to one of those buildings. So even in the hotel, you realize that you're close to what was the firing line. I woke up on September the 12th with people with machine guns on every corner, you know, seeing tanks, seeing Hummers rolling down main streets of New York City. You know, they then moved in an aircraft carrier and you had jet fighters circling the city. In a day, you know, this is what can change. I was able to witness the very worst of humanity and the very best of it as well. The response to it from people in New York was quite extraordinary.
You tried to give blood, didn't you?
Yeah, everyone tried to give blood, everyone. But it was one of those things that there is an over-response to this. We couldn't give blood because of how long the queues were.
And the truth was that there wasn't the need for it. People were either dead or alive.
That's right. The firefighters during this are using the subways to rescue people to get in and coming out just covered with this ash and seeing people applaud them, like to give them the energy to go back in, you know, to try and rescue people. It was extraordinary. And in seeing what's just happened, you know, on the East Coast of America and seeing the eerie feeling of New York before the storm hit, it did remind me of that day.
I don't know, did it make you more alive to a larger world? Because in the world of competitive swimming, it's kind of a small world in its own way, isn't it? Did that change you in any way, Ian?
I think it did. Look, I you know, I believe in fate.
Do you? Really?
Yeah, I do. And it's the kind of thing that reinforces, you know, anything that you may have felt that way or been inclined to feel. And there is a plan there for each of us. I feel for myself, it was kind of the end of living a very innocent life, and that kind of idyllic innocence of being a child and realizing that there is an ugly side to the world out there. But not feeling defeated by that, actually feeling as though it doesn't have to be that way.
You were still experiencing episodes of depression. Did you get a diagnosis eventually?
Yeah, I'd been diagnosed for having depression.
Did that help? Often giving a name to what it is that's dogging you can sometimes help, can't it?
Not really. Because I didn't like having it. I didn't want to have it. And I didn't understand it as well, because depression is being completely irrational. This is how I feel about it. And, you know, looking at what I was doing and, you know, I should feel like I'm on top of the world, but I didn't. You look that you have everything, but it feels like it's nothing. You know, I felt lonely. I may have had hundreds of numbers in my phone, but I didn't call anyone. You know, so it makes no sense. And, you know, only now do I really, you know, I address it and look at it and deal with it, not on a daily basis, because it's not an issue for me daily, but, you know, I have to work on it and work on it, looking at that it's, you know, an illness that pops up from time to time.
And you were drinking a fair bit, not to the point of alcoholism, but still drinking a fair bit. Did that help in any way?
No, it's one of those things that it makes sense at the time, but you drink so that you don't think. And you wake up the next day with a hangover and still feeling as bad as you did the day before. And you do that for a while, and then you go, this is stupid. And this is when you've become a little bit more rational, when you've got out of that. And then you realize, you know, I need to go a little bit deeper into this. You know, what is the root cause of this? What is contributing
That's
to
a
me
scary
feeling
thought,
like this?
Isn't it
really
scary
is.
Thought?
This is the last thing you want to think of, is because you've already felt like you've gone too far into it and then realizing you have to go deeper.
Looking back, do you think you might have been on the edge of some sort of awful shame spiral there, you know, feeling increasing shame and drinking more and feeling more shame, and you could have ended up in a very bad place?
I don't know. I think I was fortunate that, you know, in terms of professional help, I had really good people around me, that I didn't get to the point where, you know, this all could have gone the other way. There's a bad time and, you know, a period where, you know, I was suicidal. And, you know, you realize that this is, in terms of depression, this is when you're getting into the depths of, you know, the lowest of lows. And when you know that it's not a rational thing to do, but having a sense and a feeling that it's actually a viable option, you realize you need help. And when you go through a couple of days like that, when you can't motivate yourself to do anything else, when that is the thought that goes into your head, you again realize you need more help. And so you know, for me, you know, going through that and coming out the other side, and, you know, going through what is now an extended period where, you know, I haven't been suicidal, I haven't got close to that feeling. It shows, you know, for people that, you know, no matter what they're struggling with their depression, how severe it is or whatnot, things can get better for you. You can still achieve extraordinary things in your life, and you can actually have some control over this. You don't have to allow the depression to define you or your life. You can actually end up getting on top of it, or at least having a sense where you feel as though you're on top of it, and then the lows don't become as low as they can go.
It's like getting the flu almost. Mm-hmm. And you know it's coming, and it's going to be awful. It's going to be an end of tissues maybe or something at the end of it. But it's kind of like a storm you have to weather in your health, and you have to slow down, take a bit of stress off yourself, and not commit yourself to things, too many things, and just believe somehow that there'll be that you'll recover out of come out of the end. Are you able to do that now?
Yeah, I know when it's coming on, like, because I can see my behavior when it is starting to happen. And so, you know, there's things where you can't completely withdraw yourself because that's going to make it worse. So doing things that even if you're not enjoying them at the time, like spending time with close friends, you know, if you like cooking still, like not eating for that, just forcing yourself to do some of these things.
Gardening, you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, gardening is
a really good cure for this, apparently.
It is.
Yeah.
Having your hands in the dirt. But, you know, doing those things, and you know that you will weather that period a bit better. And you don't know how long it's going to be, maybe a few days, maybe a couple of weeks. But you can get through it and also take a lot of the pain off that if you accept that it's just that period where you're just a bit sick for that time.
Is that the thinking that was behind your announcement that you were planning to discontinue swimming for a while? Was it the kind of the need to tend to that garden?
Look, in part, yes, but mostly no. Swimming's, you know, a very personal thing for me. Is I felt that my swimming career was not my own. I felt that everyone else got a tremendous amount of enjoyment out of it, yet I wasn't. I was miserable doing it. And it wasn't the swimming itself. It was what swimming had become. Swimming wasn't just the training and the racing. It was then the press conferences, you know, the endorsements, the scrutiny.
You tend to get asked really stupid questions in press conference. I tend to notice that. That must wear you down after a bit.
Yeah, look, I prefer to be challenged by a question rather than something that people could really quickly look up. Those things can become quite tedious. I don't understand it sometimes. Sometimes I understand the line of questioning that people are trying to get a response for their article to write it in a particular way or to report on something a particular way.
Do you find that a lot of coverage of sports these days, I certainly notice it, is becoming more like coverage of politics? Journalists are looking for a gaffe.
Well, they are, and this is the problem, is we do not see personality in sport like we used to. And I know people in sport. There's some people that have great personalities, there's some people that are terribly boring as well. But I really dislike the textbook answers that you get from athletes, because athletes are not going to give you an answer. They're not going to express an opinion or their personality when they can't trust you with it. So you get nothing out of them.
That's right. And the upshot of it is it's made the sports interview a boring thing, like the politics interview now.
It has. And I'm glad that I haven't had media training.
You haven't?
I haven't, because it happened too quickly that I didn't have time to do it. But I'm glad that I didn't do it. And I'd like us to get back to a point where you can actually have some more trust in the journalists. And in some, yes, that there is that kind of trust. But in general, for athletes to be able to give a little bit more, and that's respected and it's reported on in a fair way. But it's something that I guess all of us, and it's people even in business that, you know, it's going that way in business and whatnot, the relationship with the media.
Taking a break from swimming meant you had time to focus on your charity called Fountain for Youth. Tell me about this charity. What does it do?
Well, it's now 12 years old. So it's something that I set up in 2000. But we work mostly in Indigenous remote communities. We also do some work in the cities. We have a number of different programs, but we help in Indigenous health and education, from maternal health right through to the end of high school and beyond. We have programs across all of that in over 20 Indigenous communities in the Northern Territory.
What kind of results have you been able to get?
Well, quite proudly, we have kids that outperforming their national average in NAPLAN. And it's not just because of what we're doing. It's because of a commitment of teachers of the community, being able to respond to that, to be able to give kids some resources where some of these children have grown up in bookless homes. to actually have books going out into the community to get rid of the stigma that, you know, the classroom is a white fella thing, to engage with the community, because the community actually usually has the answer to their problems, but being able to assist to give them what they need rather than telling people what to do with their own children. I think this is why we've had success in this area, and with our partners that we use, why this has been successful. And it's an approach that we take, that the government would do well in this kind of consultation rather than just consultation with Indigenous people that will give them the answer that they look for.
You made the comeback to swimming in 2010. Didn't pan out for the 2012 team for the Olympics. Nonetheless, do you feel you can do it more on your own terms now, Ian, now that you're a bit older and wiser?
Well, I am. And, you know, I realised when I started swimming again, when I was swimming previously, all of these things were very new to me. There wasn't this level of attention around, you know, a swimmer before myself. And so, you know, for me, this was all very new. I accepted when I returned that, you know, that focus would be around me. That, you know, if I was going to swim, that I had to be prepared that it wasn't just the laps. It was also other parts of it that I'm not going to enjoy so much. So I came to terms with that, and it's what has allowed me to be able to get back into swimming. And I think it was probably when I, you know, had just become comfortable with not swimming, that I, you know, with having a life after it, that I was allowed to think, you know, why not go back to swimming, regardless of being unsuccessful in trying to make the London Olympics. I'm very glad that I've returned to the sport.
You did some impromptu coaching after the London Olympics. That sounded like a lot of fun. Was that
so much fun?
So much fun. You just
too many people though.
Thousands, hundreds, thousands of people. Thousands of people showed up. But nonetheless, you had a ball, didn't you?
It was fun. Yeah. I spent hours down there because I'd been talking, you know, with the BBC. I was hosting for them during the games, and we'd been talking about legacy of a games. I'm like, well, I'm here. I've got like a free afternoon. I'll do some of my own legacy. I'll see how it goes, not knowing how many people would come. And, you know, I probably couldn't do it in Australia because like OH&S, and that I'm not registered as a coach, I'd probably not be allowed to do it. But apparently I was, so I did it. And, you know, I had a lot of fun to, you know, people were enthused by the Olympics. And so, you know, I went out there and taught people of all different levels, you know, how to do a bit of swimming.
It's been wonderful having you on the program, Ian. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Cheers. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.